You build the world. The roads, schools and hospitals. That's your work. And we're with you on this journey. Procore, your trusted construction partner. Discover our construction management platform at procore.com.
It's Wednesday, the 24th of January, 2024, and you're listening to Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop. And as usual, we'll be discussing some of the topics thrown up by the last fortnight's news. Good morning, Phil.
Morning, David.
How are you?
I'm well. How are things there in sunny Somerset? Devon.
Well, it's in Devon. Devon, actually, and it's not sunny, but at least it's not raining. Phil, let's kick off with. I mean, I think there's only really one topic of news which has broken today that we want to discuss, and that's one of the biggest infrastructure projects currently underway. That's Hinkley Point C. No surprises here that the cost is set to increase. By a substantial amount, actually.
Something between 5 and 10 billion they've put on the past, since May 2022. So that's less than 2 years ago. Yeah. They were saying it was going to be about 26 billion it would cost at 2015 prices, which was considerably up on the initial estimate of 18 billion. And now it's gone up another huge chunk, anything up to either 31 to 34 billion. So somewhere between 5 and 10 billion is going to be added on, mostly because of the delays. COVID, they're blaming for 18 months worth of delays. Then things now not going to finish until Unit 1 won't be finished until somewhere between 2029, if things go perfectly between now and then, or 2031 if things don't, and let's face it, things hardly ever do on these sort of things.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're looking at end of the decade for it to come on stream. And so the extra cost is not just materials inflation. It's the fact that they've got all these people employed on site for another however many years we're talking about. So it's not looking good. And the knock-on effect of that, of course, is that we've got Sizewell ready to go. It had the development consent order has been triggered, so they're now starting to move on the enabling works at Sizewell. And Sizewell in Suffolk. And Sizewell was in the news as well this week. It's got another £2.5 billion has been allocated to it so far. £1.3 billion yesterday, day before the government announced that they were going to make available to the Sizewell project for enabling works. I think we discussed a month or two ago about an initial chunk of money that they were getting for mainly for sweetening the deal with all the locals in the area and the neighbourhood who are upset. Yeah. There's going to be a lot of sports huts and children's playgrounds and Meals on Wheels and all sorts of social dividends. They're going to be chucking around the villages.
Bread and circuses,
To win people over. But the next, this $1.3 billion they've announced now is more for physical preparatory works for the roads and so on in the area to get the infrastructure in place to enable construction to start. But we still don't know. The actual full funding decision doesn't come. They're hoping to do it before the end of the year. But there'll probably be a change of government before then. So who knows what's going to happen?
Who knows?
But it's supposed to be. So my original point was that Sizewell is supposed to be an awful lot cheaper than Hinkley because it's following the pattern of Hinkley. And it's just we've done it before. Now we know what we're doing. It cookie cutter, replicate that. But Hinkley was supposedly a replication of the EPR reactors that have been built elsewhere in Flamanville and one in Scandinavia, I think, as well.
Yes,
they've had all their problems. So I don't know how much of a cookie cutter job Sizewell will be, but it's sure as heck not going to come in for the 20, 25 billion, which they're currently estimating it at. So it's all looking very expensive.
Yeah. Oh, well. Well, shall we, having started with that rather downbeat assessment, shall we move on to the more upbeat topic of company failures, which I think is which is another story that has come. There's an organisation called Begbie's Trainer, who I think a company. They specialise in company rescues, don't they? What do they call themselves? Yeah, business recovery specialists. They call themselves. They issue this red flag alert. Do they do it annually or do they do it?
They do it every quarter. What they do, apart from going in and helping companies restructure or running administrations and insolvencies and things like that, they sell a service of a credit watch of mm-hmm. alerting. If you've got lots of suppliers or customers and you want to keep an eye on whether you're going to get paid or not, you can buy their reports that says, yep, this is a solvent company, or no, this is a dodgy company, they're on the edge. So it's in their interest, to be fair, to scare us into thinking that everyone's about to go bust and you need to buy our, you know, give us money and we'll tell you exactly who's about to go bust. So they haven't told us who in these quarterly reports. They just give us the headline numbers. And they have two sorts of metrics or measures: critical financial distress and significant financial distress. Critical financial distress is worse than significant financial distress.
Okay.
And critical, 3 months ago, in the construction industry, they were saying there were 5,900 construction companies in critical distress. This week, they've bumped that up to 7,849. So a 33%, this is a key figure. They reckon there's been a 33% jump in construction companies about to go pop just in the past 3 months. Now, whatever the rights or wrongs of their data, the accuracy, how many of these companies will go under, is a side point that we could also discuss. But the key point is that the risks have escalated basically by a third, which is quite scary.
Yes, it is. I mean, I think a lot of people were sort of expecting things to get tougher this year because, after all, last year we saw problems with, you know, rising costs. You know, mortgage interest rates, of course, had a big trickle-down effect on the construction industry. And in fact, somebody from, I can't remember who it was, somebody from Begbie's Trainer was quoted in your article as saying that there's a debt storm has been brewing for years. Which I think probably won't come as a surprise to many people. Yeah, Begbie's Trainer partner Julie Palmer said the era of cheap money is firmly a thing of the past. Hundreds of thousands of businesses in the UK who loaded up on affordable debt during those halcyon days are now coming to terms with the added burden that this will have on their finances. So, I mean, I don't think anybody can say they didn't see it coming, but it's still rather alarming news.
Yes, the cost of debt, that's a thing, isn't it? That's a big issue. Yeah. That's a big burden.
Yeah, yeah. We've been used to sub 1% interest rates for years. And of course, that's all, you know, that's totally unsustainable. So, yeah, there we are.
Problem is, David, as we always say in this podcast, that we're quite good at asking questions waving flags at things, but we don't really have any answers. But
no.
Fortunately, today we think we've got someone who might have some.
Yes, in fact, we've been keeping him in the shadows, folks. We've got a guest on today's podcast, a guest who's returning for a second appearance, actually, I'm glad to say. It's somebody who knows a thing or two about the hazards faced by construction firms, especially those further down the supply chain. He is, of course, Rudy Klein, barrister and former CEO of the Specialist Engineering Contractors Group and lifelong campaigner. Would that be fair to say, Rudy, that you're a campaigner for subcontractors and people in need of contractual rebalancing?
Well, that's a good way of putting it, David. I like the way you put it. I mean, given this is my second time, I must be a sucker for punishment. I've campaigned really for the industry. Obviously, I happen to be representing specialist engineering contractors, which for the most part was subcontractors, but there were some that were tier one contractors and tier threes. So there were a mixture, but I think it's more about the industry, although the industry, of course, is comprised mainly of SMEs, and many SMEs, of course, are subcontractors. But I mean, the figures you were giving there from Begbie's Trainer are absolutely frightening. I'm not surprised. I mean, I'm involved in the board of one specialist contracting company. And of course, I've seen this. I mean, last year, for example, I mean, contract awards fell by about 14%, which is really quite significant. And on top of that, of course, you've got materials cost increases, although that's stabilizing now. You've got wages increasing. You've got energy costs going up, interest rates, of course. I mean, you know, you can't get a picture that's much worse than that. And I think that's what firms are now facing. Now, you might say, of course, one of the upsides of all this is that some of the zombie companies we've got in the industry, thousands of zombie companies that we seem to have, are probably gone to the wall. That's probably no bad thing because, of course, they have tended to undercut the more reputable companies that invest in training and plant and equipment and so on and the new technologies. But so, yeah, it is a rather frightening episode we're now going through. I mean, I think there are things we have to address, which I'm sure we'll discuss.
How do you spot a zombie company, do you think? I mentioned Begbie's Trainers and others that sell these, you know, credit ratings, reports and so on. But there are companies out there that, I mean, someone like Buckingham Group, who went belly up quite recently, not very many months ago, they looked like a perfectly healthy company. They're building good buildings and stadia and whatever and doing things and going about their business, and then they're gone. What are the warning signs that you've picked up from your experience?
I think the warning signs usually are that their payments, I mean, to talk about Buckingham, their payment, because I have some experience with Buckingham, because the payment record was getting worse and worse. It was taking longer and longer to make payments. And then, of course, the word gets around. And the unfortunate thing, of course, is that when word gets around, people then say, oh, okay, we're not going to work for Buckingham. Then, of course, trade credit insurers start to pick up on this. Well, they pick up on it very early. So they either withdraw trade credit or they bump up their premiums. And then that's it. You're on the way down then.
Mm. It's a snowball effect, isn't it? Everything just gathers speed.
It does, yeah. It just carries on until the end comes, and the end usually comes fairly quickly. Mm. But what I mean by zombie companies, I mean basic companies that simply have benefited over the years from very low interest rates, have invested very little in skills, in the new technologies, in fact, invest very little in anything, probably operating from half a shed, but because their overheads are so low, they can offer the lowest price, and then they don't have a problem when they go bust. They'll probably start up again under a new name, usually, of course. But I think you know, the industry, of course, you know, tends to encourage the zombie company issue because there are not many barriers to entry to the industry.
Yeah, that's true.
So for the most part, anybody can come in. I mean, you know, I've just been working with a trade body on registering electricians in Scotland or licensing electricians in Scotland. But, I mean, the thing is, of course, you can call yourself an electrician, but you're not qualified to call yourself an electrician, but you can still do that. I mean, I know there are certain restrictions in England, for example, with Part P, if you're working on the electrics in a domestic property, but nonetheless, we don't have many barriers to entry, and that's one of the problems we have as an industry, that anybody and everybody can come in.
Isn't that a good thing though to have a dynamic economy?
Well, it might be, but for the client, the consumer, it's not a good thing. If I mean, especially when you have people liable, in fact, to cause unsafe installations or buildings. You know, I don't think it's good for the client. It's good for the consumer because you just don't know what you're getting. So, you know, and of course, it means the image of the industry suffers.
You're leading me down a tangent here, Rudy, but you mentioned the Scottish Electricians campaign, and I get that you have to be gas safe registered to work with gas. So why not be something similar for electricity? I see that argument. But it sounds like you might be a supporter of this wretchedly stupid idea that builders should have to have a license to put up a wall.
Well, interestingly, after the Edinburgh Schools debacle, you know, in 2016, where a a wall fell down in Edinburgh School that could have killed loads of children. Of course, they were very fortunately they were on holiday at the time. Maybe there is the case for licensing builders. I mean, if you're in Australia, most states in Australia have licensing regimes for builders,
yes, but,
as well as for other trades, you know.
But the contractor on that job in Scotland, I think it was if memory serves, it was Morrison, who was a top reputable, you know, tier one contractor, good name and so on. And if you know, they wouldn't have any trouble getting a license. So a license doesn't stop these things happening.
Maybe their bricklayer wasn't there.
No, it's not. It can never be a guarantee, but at least you have as a client or customer some assurance that the party you're engaging possesses a level of competence. And of course, competence is the in word now with the Building Safety Act, because we've got the Act now fully enforced for the most part. This year we'll see the Act really coming into its own. So the first time we've had to have a regulator. We've never had a regulator in the industry before. Now we have a building safety regulator, who is going to focus very much on competence of individuals, competence of businesses, to make sure that what we are doing is safe. And of course, all that will tally very much with, of course, that we've got the Grenfell inquiry report coming out this year as well, which is probably going to say some unpleasant things about the industry.
Mm. Undoubtedly.
You know, so we've got to be alive, I think, to this theme of competence.
I know that I mentioned at the outset that you've campaigned a lot for sort of contractual reform in the industry. I saw last year, you were talking about how we need another Construction Act. Of course, things changed quite drastically. I think it was in 1996 when the housing grants, and I can't remember what the full name is, but what we call the Construction Act. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And yeah, that changed a lot of things, you know, introduced things like statutory adjudication. Do you think we need another sort of overhaul of the same sort of magnitude as that, and a new act?
Well, I think we need certainly improvements to it. I think you're right, David. I mean, you know, that's not to say what we have hasn't been any good. I think it's been fairly effective, particularly, for example, the statutory right of suspension.
Yeah.
The abolition of pay when paid. I mean, it's not totally abolished. Unfortunately, not abolished in the case of insolvency. But I mentioned insolvency. What we could be doing is actually abolishing pay when paid on insolvency. So, you know, a contractor cannot say to a subcontractor, look, the client's gone bust, I'm not going to pay you. That's completely, utterly wrong. So the things like that we need to address. We need to address retention as well. You know, in the last, 5 years since we had the consultation on reforming the practice of retention, between £2.5 and £3 billion worth of retention monies have been lost by firms, mainly SMEs in the industry. And I mean, that's absolutely scandalous. Mm. And yet the government still refuses to address it. Before Christmas, there was a debate in the House of Lords on retentions, and the Lord Offord, who was the minister, the junior minister representing the government, nobody knows him, but he's representing the government, said, oh, well, it's for the industry to get a consensus on this. But there was a consensus, because when the government consulted 5 years ago, the overwhelming majority of respondents said, we want to reform the retention system, we want to protect monies. Mm. Then you had silly people like Build UK saying, oh, we'll head this off, led by their tier one contractor members. We'll head this off because our big members want to use these monies. So what we'll do, we'll say, we'll have a roadmap, 5-year roadmap. 5 years' time, by 2025, we'll get rid of retentions. And the Construction Leadership Council, or the government's quango, said, yeah, we'll take that over, because it meant that they didn't need to do anything. So the result is, you know, the industry loses between £2.5 and £3 billion because of upstream insolvency. And then we turn around and say, OK, well, big problem. Sorry about that. But we're still going to get rid of retentions by 2025. If anybody believes in 2025, construction will be a retention-free zone, I'll shoot them personally. you know, I mean, it's unbelievable. But I mean, it is scandalous. Mm. And I think, you know, the likes of Build UK and its acolytes, like the Civil Engineering, the Contractors Association, who supported them, they should be now answering for what they've done, which is, I say, basically to deflect a very successful campaign that had the support of the majority of MPs in the House of Commons for legislation to protect retention money. Mm. It's just inexcusable.
Mm. Long grass, very handy place.
Sorry, I mean, you know, frustration sometimes sets in.
Yeah, inevitably. Well, your old organisation, the SEC, was that sort of subsumed into Build UK? I can't remember.
No, we weren't. I think a couple of member bodies were members of Build UK, but SecGroup wasn't. In fact, SecGroup actually led the campaign to address the retention issue and led it for about 20 years. It's gone off the ball a little now, but I think, you know, when I've been saying to anybody who cares to listen, look, we've got an election coming up. You know, the Labour Party says it supports legislation on fair payment. Well, okay, when we're talking to our prospective MPs, let's remind them we need legislation that will protect retention monies. We need legislation that will mandate project bank accounts and or direct payments. And do you support it? And if you support it, yeah, okay, I'll vote for you. But we've got a lot of things to address, I think, still with regard to payment, because the problems are still out there. I mean, the Construction Industry Collective Voice in Scotland did a survey before Christmas, and in Scotland, 80% of respondents, and there was a lot of respondents to the survey, reported that payment problems were continuing. They were still getting monies delayed. 63% were saying, well, actually, you know, we got all our applications were reduced, but nobody told us why they were reduced. Hmm. And 73% reported that they had severe problems in getting all of their retentions. So although the Construction Act clearly has helped, these kind of problems are continuing, and we need to look at effective measures to address the likes of project bank accounts, which we've been quite successful within the devolved regions, you know, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. The UK government has been rather lax in enforcing the imposition of PBAs, but everybody I've spoken to have benefited from PBAs have said really that they are the way to go. I mean, even governments admit that they are the most effective means to secure payments, but okay, if we've got that in place, why don't we do it? Well, we're not doing it because we've got, you know, certain people like, you know, the chap who co-chairs the CLC is saying they're against PBAs, and of course they're trying to influence government on the matter. So that's the problem we have.
Hmm. Thing is, though, assuming we have a change in government later this year, there's no way an incoming Labour government is going to grasp the nettle or be interested in construction contract reform. It's just not going to be top of its priority list at all. It might get interested in the construction industry. In fact, it probably will if it comes in a month or two after the Grenfell report is published. That'll be a real hot potato and a big outcry over that. It'll be, you know, a bit like the sub-postmasters. There'll be a big political brouhaha. It's inevitable, and rightly so. And they will probably have to do more something on building safety reforms, even though we think we've solved that problem already, or the current government does. But the only way that what you're talking about, and retentions and so on, late payments and all this stuff, is going to get into the political agenda, is if we have another carillion between now and the next election. You know, a big tier one go belly up with lots and lots of damage and outfall, and then there'll be some political momentum, and the new government will come in and go, oh, yeah, we really need to do that. We need to act. Do you think we should be actually hoping for the collapse? You know, could that be for the benefit of the industry, for a big tier one company to go belly up in the next few months?
Well, that's never really to the benefit of anybody, is it? When they do, though, I must say that when Carillion collapsed, you know, there was all sorts of statements issued by government that, you know, significant and substantial reform is necessary in the industry, in procurement, contracts, but that, of course, never happened. and Carillion really didn't lead to anything of consequence. But I think a new government, I mean, when you refer to the Labour government, I mean, the Labour Party, I mean, not a government yet, looking at their agenda, there is going to be in their manifesto fact that they will address fair payments. So that's already there. I mean, not in the manifesto, but it's a commitment that the party have already made. And I mean, I'm in touch with some MPs who are in the party, Debbie Abrahams, for example, who has been campaigning for many years on payment reform. So I think there's an interest certainly in taking this matter up, because I think there's also an understanding it's not payment in isolation we're talking about here. Payment impacts upon safety. I mean, Dame Judith Hackett, in her report on building safety in May 2018, made it very, very clear. She said payment abuse, tensions, and so on lead to compromises on quality, because people will cut corners if they're not getting their attention or if they're not being paid. The impact on mental health, as we all know, of non-payment. People running businesses, small businesses, not getting paid. The impact on mental health is extraordinary. And it's not necessarily that people suffer at the serious end of mental health issues, but people just suffer stress and because they're being abused. So I would have thought, given the wider and the broader impact that the payment problems have, an incoming government, such as say if it was to be the Labour Party, I'm sure they would be extremely interested in addressing it. And so and certainly with the problems that we have in the industry, I mean, you were talking about Hinkley and the costs there, Phil, and increasing costs. You know, all late payment adds to costs, adds to risk, insolvency risk, and so on. All batters projects. All these problems mean that projects just simply don't come in on time. If people are suspended because they haven't been paid, that delays as well. So there are all these effects, these consequences of an industry that relies on practicing payment abuse.
I don't think many people, apart from tier one contractors that you've been talking about, would disagree with anything you said. Certainly, I concur with all of that. And you think there's a chance that, not a chance, you suspect that an incoming Labour government will be sympathetic to all of this. But whether it will actually happen or not, one of my Christmas presents was Rory Stewart's book, the ex-MP candidate for Tory leadership, Politics on the Edge, which I finished reading the other day. And it talks about his experiences of being a government minister. And it's quite clear the insight that he brings. I mean, not just we see these housing ministers, construction ministers, all these ministers and secretaries of state chopping and changing every 15 minutes. But even when they do stay in post, it's very, very hard. Ministers are quite sort of frustrated when they get into office to discover how actual little power they have to do anything, to affect anything. And there is this sort of machinery of government, which is titanic in a sea of Mars bars, which you cannot turn in any direction. So even if a Labour government wants to affect change, how confident are you that it will happen, given how little has happened over the past decades?
Well, I know and fully understand the description of government that you've just given me, Phil, because in fact I've been dealing with ministers and civil servants over many years. And I've seen that, you know, it just annoys me, and it has annoyed me on the odd occasion when a minister turns around to me and says, what does X think? X being a civil servant. And I say, well, what do you think? I just find that annoying. There are ministers, of course, who will try and rule the roost a bit more, but as you say, that doesn't often happen. But let me just go back to the Construction Act. One of the surprising things about that, in fact, was that the government that initiated that was actually a Conservative government. Then the whole process was completed actually by then a Labour government. But when we go back to that, and I was heavily involved in that, we organized probably the most extensive lobbying campaign in the industry ever to get that legislation. And we were prepared to spend millions to get it. And I would have thought that if there was a chance of getting reform, then the industry would certainly need to lobby. We can't simply rely on any government, whatever their political hue, to introduce a legislation to support the industry. What we've got to do, and what firms in the industry have got to do, coming up to the general election this year, is to be lobbying their members of parliament and saying, look, we need to do these things. We need legislation to mandate PBAs or direct payments. We need legislation to protect retention monies. This is the impact our business are suffering at the moment with the current situation. We have to address these things. So I think one can never take anything for granted, but you've got to actually be talking to the MPs at ground level and getting commitments from your MPs. And that is what we did with the Construction Act. We had this widespread lobbying with firms talking to the MPs. We organised breakfast meetings with MPs. We did a massive job in engaging members of parliament. That's the only way you can do it. So we've got election come out with a great year to be able to influence anything. Let's be talking to our prospective members of parliament as soon as the date for the election is announced.
So are you talking about individual companies lobbying and you know, actually making it for themselves?
And individual firms, David, you know, anybody and everybody. And, you know, we've got people are prepared to listen. I think if the Labour Party is saying they're going to address fair payment, well, obviously they're in a mode that's prepared to listen.
I mean, you were talking about Build UK and the CLC earlier, and not in the most flattering terms. I mean, do you think that they are a good mouthpiece for the industry?
That's a very good question, David. I
think I know the answer, though.
Some words in response that you will not be able to broadcast.
Okay.
let me just deal with CLC.
Yes, go on.
I wrote a piece in industry publication, I think last year, which basically says over the time that the CLC has been in being, they came to be in 2013, they have done nothing or little to address the job for which they were brought into being. And that job was to attain certain targets for the industry, for example, reducing prices by 30%, reducing costs by 30%, reducing construction times by 50%, you know, and all these measures, all these KPIs have absolutely failed. They are, and the trouble is that the industry doesn't really know much about what they do. They are essentially a government quango, but what they are good for and what they've been really good for is for the business department to be able to say in Parliament, well, of course, you know, in response to any issue regarding construction, well, you know, the Construction Leadership Council will pick this up, or the Construction Leadership Council has been doing that, this and the other. And, of course, your average politician sitting there in the House, oh, they've got the Construction Leadership Council. That sounds like a representative body. Oh, isn't that good to hear? Well, it's absolutely utter crap. So, you know, they have really done nothing of any consequence. I mean, they will say, oh, well, during COVID, we put out all this guidance. You know, well, does it need a high-level strategic body in place to put out some guidance? You know, I just despair. I mean, the only thing that I probably can say about them is to get they've got some involvement from the industry. But if you look at the board of the CLC, there's nobody representing SMEs and small businesses. So
no.
They are the majority of the industry. You mentioned Build UK. Well, I probably not put them in the same bracket, but I mean, the trouble with Build UK, they are represented by their large tier one contractors, and that they seem to rule the roost. I mean, they've got a number of trade bodies in membership, but the upper hand is held by their large tier one contractor members. So we've got to be very careful as to how we treat them, but that really is the truth. I don't hold them out as a body for change. I mean, I think just on change, though, David, I think what is interesting on what I'm fortified by is that there are growing movements in the industry comprising activists who really want to change. I mean, I've just been working with a fintech startup called Sable. And they're looking at how we can improve the project bank account process using digital platforms that will save having to set one up anew every time you start a project or try and get the banks to provide the traditional banks to provide the product. So they're now looking to improve the product substantially using digital means. There's the Save the Construction Initiative. I mean, it's a group of people, a lot of young people involved, keen to address some of the problems in the industry, particularly from the procurement end, a more integrated industry that where people are engaged from the outset, delivering project outcomes, saving costs, working together to improve matters, you know, such as safety. I mean, we can't net zero. Everyone talked about net zero. We ain't going to get to net zero in an industry that is totally, utterly fragmented, that is hierarchical, where appointments are made sequential, where there are, you know, between 50 and 70 tier one subcontractors and projects. You know, how are we going to deliver all this stuff? You know, nobody seems to have an answer to that.
Yeah, that's a whole different can of worms, the sort of net zero thing. I mean, it's made to sound very achievable, and if you look at the conditions on the ground, it looks hopelessly complicated and unachievable.
Well, it does, David. I mean, 2 years ago, King's College issued a report that said, well, if the only real way of achieving net zero is for the traditional procurement to be abandoned in favour of reliancing. Which involves people, all project participants, working together closely to achieve these objectives. But you can't do it with a traditional procurement system as we now have.
So how likely is that? It seems a long way off.
it does, but that leads, you see, though, to another point, which is I believe that I said earlier we have a building safety regulator. But building safety resonates with so many other issues, as I was describing earlier. So why don't we have a construction regulator across the board to promote best practice in procurement to deal with problems that people are having with bad practice? We need a driver. The government's not going to drive anything. We need an independent regulator. I mean, it's interesting. In Singapore, they established about 12 years ago, I think it's 12, maybe 14 years ago, an authority called the Building Construction Authority. And that authority was set up independently to drive improvement in construction. And they've done that, with a particular focus on SMEs.
So you're suggesting a sort of an Ofsted or Ofcom for the construction industry?
Yes. Well, when you look at Ofsted, Ofcom, all these other organizations, all these regulators, particularly for the utilities. I mean, one of their roles is to improve practices in the sector that they're regulating. That is one of their roles. That's one of their statutory functions. And, you know, I now really think that given the, you know, what I was saying about the CLC, about government, what we need is a statutory regulator that has this role to drive improvement.
I mean, a bit more difficult, I would have thought, with the construction industry, which, as you said yourself, is very fragmented and, of course, goes from the big tier one contractors right down to the one man and his van sort of thing. Not quite the same as Ofcom or Ofsted, which is a far more cohesive sort of industry sector or business sector to deal with.
Yeah, you're right. You're not going to do this overnight. I think you're going to have to choose within the, because the industry in itself is made up of different sectors anyway. You know, we've got renewables now, of course, in another emerging sector. So I think if we're going to regulate medicine, we're going to have to move from one sector to the next and start off with sectors that you can manage quite well and drive improvement quite well.
Okay.
I mean, to me, the priority must be, you know, given what Phil was saying earlier about Hinckley, the priority must be infrastructure.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. I mean, look at the hospital schools program. The hospital program, I mean, that's been off course now for a little while. I mean, they're hoping to get it back on course. You know, we're supposed to have these 40 hospitals built by 2030. You know, well, okay, pigs can fly, but the thing is, that to me should be the initial focus because, you know, I mean, look at the waste. I mean, the National Audit Office end of last year, reported the amount of waste in infrastructure spend that they've seen. There's little accounting really and auditing of infrastructure projects. So I think, I mean, the NAO can't do this themselves. They've got other sectors to think about as well of government spend. So I think certainly an industry, a statutory industry regulator, I mean, extending really the building safety regulator model across the board, now that we have a safety regulator, it shouldn't be too difficult.
Hmm. Sorry, Rudy, I part company with you here. Looking to Singapore for a model and say, oh, Singapore, they know how to do it. They know how to regulate things. I think even the Labour Party today would be wary of this sort of over-regulation for an economy. I mean, I understand all the things about safety and quality or whatever else, but at the end of the day, construction companies are businesses and they exist to make money. And if it's so heavily regulated, no one's going to make money. No one's going to go into the business. I just think it's, you can go too far the other way. I mean, there's sort of a parallel with the whole move away from the supremacy on a project of the resident engineer or the architect. And then we move towards design and build, which represented a big deregulation of the industry. And that was why the Scottish school that you talked about earlier, the wall fell apart, was because of the fault lines in design and build, and that's never really been tackled. I would advocate, rather than moving some government regulation, because let's face it, governments aren't very good at things, and return to the supremacy of the resident engineer and the architect and get a bit of, you know, personal responsibility back in the job.
You talk about the fact that, and I agree with you, you know, businesses are there to make money, but, you know, for heaven's sake, I mean, businesses are not making money in the industry, and that's been the case for quite some time. And one of the reasons, or a major reason why they're not making money, is because they are locked into a process that is so unfriendly business-wise. Our traditional procurement delivery systems are so unfriendly to businesses. We've payment abuse that I've been talking about for a while now. That's unfriendly to businesses. Contractual abuse, unfriendly to businesses. I mean, you know, you wouldn't believe some of the stuff I've seen, you know, that small businesses have to put up with, the kind of contracts that they get. We all know what a syndrome of, you know, risk transfer, loading or risk down the supply chain. They can't cope. The time they have to take just to try and read, if they dare to read some of the contracts they get, that will take up all their time, leaving a little time, in fact, for doing what they're supposed to be about. So there's so many fault lines there in the industry at the moment, particularly with regard to risk, and particularly also design risk, when we talk about risk, the design doesn't work. But the amount of risk that falls on the supply chain is phenomenal, and that does not allow for making money. And I think, you know, we've given enough chance, haven't we? We've given, you know, a couple of hundred years opportunities to for the industry to see whether it can move into a modern, vibrant digital era. You know, we've had reports galore, hundreds of them over the years, and I looked at 15 reports that came out, I think, in a 5-year period a few years ago. I was looking at all these reports and look at the recommendation and say, has that happened? You know, yes. I mean, CLC, published a report in 2016 called Modernize or Die. Excellent report with a lot of recommendations. Did the CLC pick those up? No. Did government pick those up? No. Nobody did. And yet what we do, we're now lumbered with absolutely nothing. No, nobody is thinking about really how we move forward. What I'm coming up is trying to say, look, we've tried to do things. In most cases, we haven't done anything. What's the other route? What's the other angle now we need to be looking at? I'm afraid a more regulated industry is the only way forward. If someone could show me some other way that it's going to be just as, or if not more effective, tell me, for goodness sake.
Oh, well, so the fight continues then, Rudy. You're still campaigning. You're still putting it out there.
Well, I am, yeah. I've got my own little legal business, but I'm still dealing with a lot of trade bodies. I have a few firms, clients. So I'm still seeing at first hand some of these issues, but I enjoy writing. I still write for the construction press. And do things like this.
Well, we're very grateful. We're glad that you do.
Well, we enjoy listening to you and enjoy reading your articles, Rudy.
Yes.
Never short of opinions. Is there anything you've not got an opinion on?
Well, outside of construction.
Well, I don't...
Probably a lot. Well, with construction, I've been involved with construction for over 35 years. So if I didn't have an opinion on all matters construction, I think there'd be something wrong with me.
Yeah. Hear, hear.
Well, my takeaway message is anyone listening, everyone listening, should be getting in touch with all your local candidates in the next general election, before the next general election. If you know who they are, if they've been selected already, contact them now and tell them what's going on in your experience in the construction industry and make the case for, as Rudy says, payment reforms, project bank accounts, retentions, abolition, and so on. Start working everyone from the ground up. So that's my takeaway. And for another episode of Reconstruction, I think from David and I would just like to say thank you, Rudy Klein, very much indeed for joining us again. And we hope to have you back on again, hopefully rather sooner than 3 years' time. Have you on in next year sometime, but maybe after the election to see what the...
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Early report or early assessment of the new government. And we'll take it from there. But for this week, thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.